From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
For those of you around the state of Illinois who wanted to send me a message, let me be clear, I have heard you.
You know, as I know, that Bruce Rauner had to be challenged in this election.
Yeah.
You knew that. But today, the popular revolt against the political ruling class fell just a bit short.
We have a president in the White House right now. If he could gut the Civil Rights Act of 1965, he would do it, and he'd do it now. Let's vote yes and pass the ERA now.
My name is Elena Hampton. During my time of employment with the Democratic Party in 2016 and 2017, my supervisor was harassing me for a span of 5 months.
An Illinois state representative is resigning after an ex-girlfriend filed a revenge porn complaint against him.
I was asked to come forward today by the people who knew about the abuse that I've suffered.
I'm going to say this just once. From beginning to end, the allegations are absurd.
Please join me in welcoming my friend, Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker.
Join me in beginning our third century in Illinois with hope and optimism and living every day better for the 200 years we lived before it.
I would like to say thank you to all the people of Illinois for the opportunity to serve you.
The year in Illinois government and politics, we saw an expensive election, a new governor elected, a budget passed on time, and fallout from the Me Too movement. Those are some of the topics we're going to talk about today on a year-end wrap-up of State Week in Springfield. I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House Editor. Daisy Contreras, IPR State House Reporter, and also IPR Reporter Rachel Otwell joining us for this edition of State Week. Let's start with the election, though. This was the dominating headline of the year. Always big elections when it comes to state government, but this one made national news basically for the money spent. And Daisy, J.B. Pritzker, of course, beating Bruce Rauner, actually beat him rather handily, but the numbers were pretty mind-boggling.
Yes, the race for Illinois governor is considered one of the most expensive races, especially when we had one billionaire and one near-billionaire both running for the seat. Pritzker put in about $171 million of his own money, while Rauner put in about $70 million. Now, we don't know where the money went, if it was funneled into other races, but we can say that the money was a big talking point. And as reporters following the race, we weren't getting much from the candidates, but we were always wondering just how much money was coming in. Definitely made headlines across the country and was an issue of interest. Now, in the primaries, we saw this wasn't much of an issue for Rauner's opponent, State Representative Jeannie Ives, who was clearly outspent by Rauner, but who still managed to come in very close to winning.
Well, I guess when you get two uber wealthy people who really want to win, and there's question, of course, about Bruce Rauner, whether he wanted to be in this race or not. He still spent a lot of money. Charlie, your thoughts on just overall, is there a fallout from this going forward? I mean, is it now this is the bar that's set for how much money it's going to take to win the Illinois governor's race in future years?
I would certainly hope not, although when the final campaign spending reports are filed, they're due on December 31st. The total amount spent on this governor's race, not just by Rauner and by Pritzker, but also by the other two candidates who are on the ballot in November, Cass Jackson, the Libertarian, Sam McCann, the Conservative, plus all the people who ran, not just Jeannie Ives on the Republican side, but the half dozen or so Democrats who ran seeking the nomination that Pritzker already got, or ultimately got, will wind up having spent more money than ever before in U.S. history on a governor's race. And as I say, I hope it doesn't get to the point where you have to have this huge kind of campaign war chest, because it does two things, I think. One, it makes it harder for people of less than extravagant means to be able to run, or if they want to run, they have to turn to the big bucks donors to try and get the money to pay for these kinds of campaigns. And as I say, I don't think it's good long term. Now, as somebody who's a longtime reporter, it's probably great for the TV stations that got all that negative ads. They got paid for that. It's good for the online promoters who got paid tons of money on all kinds of social media to run all these ads. But I don't think it's good for the citizens as a whole.
And it was fatiguing, Brian, I felt, during this year, because we started seeing, especially J.B. Pritzker, we started hearing ads from him almost a year before the primary.
Yeah, well, I'm in the fortunate position. Not, this is going to sound snottish, but I don't actually watch a lot of TV that has commercials on it. I do watch a fair amount of PBS. I'm a bit of a nerd that way. But, you know, the DVR is also a great boon in this era. You can just fast forward right past those commercials. But, yes, if you were subjected to that, or if you use Facebook or Pandora or Spotify or any of the number of, you know, newer media, so-called new media outlets where you can be bombarded with ads, they were there. And that's what, I mean, when you spend the amount of money, as Daisy was talking about, the amount of money that these candidates had available to them, it's essentially limitless for the purposes of political advertising. You can be everywhere, and money is no object. And you know, it is, to Charlie's point, I thought he raised an interesting question about whether now we're going to be setting a pattern where you have to have a super rich candidate. And I think that one of the reasons Pritzker was so attractive to Democrats is that Governor Rauner was helping to lead a fight in Illinois that has been going on a long time across the country. And it's something else we saw happen this year, which is to weaken public employee unions. They are still one of the strongest, one of the only have been one of the only growing areas of the labor movement. And this year, there was a case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, Janus versus AFSCME, that ended the so-called fair share fees, that the not union dues, but fees for services that state employees and other government employees who had to join, who didn't have to join the unions, but they had to pay the fees for the services the union provided, such as handling grievances, negotiating contracts and benefits and those sort of things. And that is, those unions, from a separate pool of money, have been a significant funding source for the Democratic Party. So as they were anticipating this decision, because it seemed fairly inevitable based on the conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, this is, they have been bracing themselves and looking for these rich candidates. And so now that you have a super rich Democratic candidate holding the governor's office in Illinois, you've got to imagine the Republicans are going to be looking for someone who can match him 4 years from now. And you do kind of get locked into this cycle. And in fact, our friend of the show, Chris Mooney, the political scientist at the University of Illinois Chicago, has identified this as a national trend. He calls them super rich neophytes. And something like a quarter of the people who were governor, at least before the election this year, are these ultra uber wealthy people, and many of them had never held political office before running for governor before.
Well, Daisy, I suppose if you wanted to look at it kind of cynically, it used to be that the rich guys would buy a baseball team or a basketball team. Now they want to buy an executive office.
Well, it goes beyond just money to me, though, because, I mean, the amount of money that Bruce Rauner put into this campaign would have been enough to, in many cases, win rather handily, you'd think. But his message, for whatever reason, didn't get through. He was an unpopular governor going into this race, and J.B. Pritzker won easily. So what it tells me also is, at least at this moment in time, Illinois is a very Democratic state, maybe more so than we even thought.
Yeah, I mean, even after the primaries, there was a lot of talk about the fence mending that each party needed to do with their respective base. But I believe Governor Rauner had the more difficult task. There was the obvious divide within the Republican Party after Rauner barely beat State Representative Jeannie Ives, who had substantial support from the more conservative Republican base. They were upset with Rauner after he signed into law legislation expanding public funding of abortions. And Ives herself said many times that conservative Republican voters felt betrayed and that many were not thinking about voting for him in the general election. So yes, to your point, Sean, Illinois is leaning more Democrat.
And Charlie and Brian, I'll bring you both in on this. The fact that Bruce Rauner was able to win 4 years ago, that was a bit of an anomaly in Illinois, too, because usually when somebody would win this, they have some type of public service background. Maybe they served in state government in some way, or they at least did something else that sort of put them in the public spotlight. Rauner winning, and of course, being a businessman and just coming in without that experience. And now J.B. Pritzker, the same thing.
Yeah, and I look back on the governors that I covered, starting with Richard Ogilvie, and they all had some background in public service, either at a local level. Ogilvie at one point was the sheriff of Cook County. He was then the county board president. Jim Thompson was a federal prosecutor. Jim Edgar was in the legislature. He was the Secretary of State. George Ryan was in the legislature, Secretary of State. Rod Blagojevich had been in the House and in Congress.
Pat Quinn.
Pat Quinn had been state treasurer, I believe, lieutenant governor. So they all had, they didn't start at the top as Rauner did. And I still believe that had Rauner unveiled his anti-union, pro-business agenda during the campaign 4 years ago, he would have lost to Pat Quinn. A lot of people voted for Bruce Rauner because he was not Pat Quinn. A lot of public sector employees were upset with Quinn because he pushed through what turned out to be unconstitutional legislation that would have reduced pension benefits. And so they voted for Bruce Rauner, who they didn't know a whole lot about, but they figured anybody's going to be better than Pat Quinn. Well, they were certainly wrong.
I will say, though, I'm not quite ready to write the obituary of the Illinois Republican Party. I mean, to be clear, they do have a very steep hill to climb. They are now in the super minority status in both the House and the Senate. And even more importantly, Democrats seem to have a firm grip on the map-making process where they can help cement their majorities for the next 10 years, assuming that things don't change electorally in 2020 in terms of the, you know, a massive upset in the House and Senate. But having a Democrat in the governor's mansion for the redistricting process, which will happen in the 2021-22 legislative session, will be significant for Democrats. However, Governor Rauner went into this election, and he had made this case towards the end of the year. He talked about how he had tried to replace himself on the ballot because he, you know, basically saw the writing on the wall. And yes, President Trump, being as unpopular as he is in many populated parts of Illinois, certainly probably dragged Governor Rauner down. But Governor Rauner was uniquely unpopular because he was viewed as somebody who was basically bad at his job. Illinois, you know, 2 years of headlines of Illinois can't even get a budget, is not a good reelection platform. It's not a good place to start running for reelection. His popularity was really low. But if you have, you can still imagine, I think, in this state, and the model is set, was set in Illinois by people like Jim Edgar, George Ryan, who were relatively socially moderate, ostensibly fiscally conservative, although you'll find Republicans today who would argue with that description. And then you also see people like the governor in Massachusetts now, who is a Republican and one of the most popular in the country. So there is still a model and a template out there. Let's remember that in 2010, a Republican almost beat Governor Pat Quinn. So I certainly think it's possible. It'll be harder in the legislature, again, because Democrats control the map-making process. But, the next 4 years are going to involve some very difficult choices regarding taxes and dealing with the problems, the fiscal problems in state government. And that could make a challenging reelection environment for Governor Pritzker in 2022. But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves.
Yeah,
this is supposed to be a look back year.
that in my mind, the key to the Republican Party being able to thrive in Illinois is to have people who are moderates, not people like Jeannie Ives who want to purify the party of all those rhinos, Republicans in name only, but people who look at it as we have to attract more people. And I think one of the keys is going to be the Republican Party is going to have to shed its anti-Hispanic image. That is not created by people in Illinois. That's created out in Washington, particularly by President Trump. I think he drug most of the Republican ticket down in Illinois, particularly in the suburbs, where some seats, some areas that had never elected a Democrat turned out and wound up voting for a Democrat. Now, part of it was the Get Out the Vote campaign organized by the Pritzker people. But in the long range, unless the Republican Party can find a way to attract people who are Hispanic, it's not going to do well in Illinois. Our Hispanic population is growing. It will continue to grow. And as I say, you have to have a message that appeals to those people. And all this nonsense about building the wall and keep those people out and rip the kids away from their moms, that kind of garbage, which makes you embarrassed to be an American, that's not going to help Republicans in the long run in the state of Illinois.
And it also, you know, makes me kind of wonder, you know, if we've seen the last of Jeanne Ives. I think that she had a lot of support during her run for governor. And, you know, maybe she is the one to kind of help restructure the party in some form or another.
Well, I think she wants to. We'll see if she's if she has the backing to do that. But you're right on that. I don't think we have seen the last of her necessarily. But let's move on, because there were some other things that happened this year. The election certainly dominated. Rachel Otwell's joining us now. And Rachel, you covered what was a pretty landmark accomplishment, I guess you would say, in the state of Illinois, and that is the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment many years after this was first proposed.
Yeah, even in my short career, I had started covering this in 2014, as it's a perennial issue. Equal Rights Amendment had gone to the states for ratification in 1972. President Nixon even was a fan. And so 46 years later, Illinois ratified with a single vote to spare. And if we want to talk about the changes people say the ERA could bring on,
sure. I mean, I think that was a big question at the time was, you know, is it needed today? There were some people saying, hey, we've, you know, that women have come a long way since this was first introduced, both in workplace, protections and other protections. Was it needed? And I think the arguments on both sides of that.
Yeah. Heather Staines, when I talked to her in 2014, had said it's a symbolic thing. At this point, a lot of changes have already been made. Policies have been whittled out of law already that many find discriminatory, including in regards to military pay and pregnancy discrimination, Social Security benefits. But she changed her tune this year. People are saying, it is needed. For instance, President Barack Obama's administration gave women the opportunity to formally serve in the military, something they had already been doing. But that opened up veterans' benefits that come with service. And now under the Trump administration, you know, people are worried that's eroding. So that's just one example of some of the solid benefits people are arguing for. Efforts for ratification to reach the 38 states needed are still underway. Virginia is being looked at as the last state that could be doing this, as efforts are underway there. And then there's the whole issue of the deadline, which was 1982, set by Congress. Worth noting that those things are not necessarily hard and fast rules. The 27th Amendment, for instance, took over 200 years to reach adoption.
Well, Charlie, you covered this from back in the 70s when it was first getting all the attention and all the controversy at the time at the Capitol, and the spectacle, really, that surrounded it. Why now? Why did this come back now? Why do you think that was able to get passed at this point?
I honestly don't know. Rachel probably has a better idea than I. But yeah, I was there for all of the circus that went on, the protests outside, both by people who favored the Equal Rights Amendment and by the anti-people. Some of the arguments made on the floor I thought were ludicrous. But then that happens in most controversial issues. Some of the floor debate makes you scratch your head. Are these people sane? And one of the, I thought, big ironies about the whole issue was that the Illinois Constitution, the one that was put together in 1970, and I covered the convention, includes in the Bill of Rights of the Illinois Constitution language that is virtually identical to the proposed federal amendment. And it was put in there. I don't recall there being any great debate. There weren't people getting up and screaming and shouting on the floor. There was nobody chaining themselves to the door of the old state capitol. There was nobody out there with pieces of pie for delegates, trying to convince them that a woman's place is in the home, in the kitchen, baking pies. It was relatively non-controversial. And the Constitution obviously was ratified by the voters of Illinois. And it wasn't until a couple years later that all this furor erupted. And to be honest, I'm not sure why they brought it back now. But I think it's something we should have done a long time ago, so I guess better late than never.
Well, Rachel, one of the things that was going on in the background, I guess you could say, behind the ERA, was this whole Me Too movement that had begun, and that was getting a lot of play in the state of Illinois as well.
Yeah, so State Representative Lou Lang, a Democrat, had been carrying this measure for a decade plus, maybe even multiple decades. And one thing he had said was, in the midst of the Me Too movement, he figured people who had been straddling the fence, so to say, might be pushed over the edge in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment. The next day, in less than 24 hours after it was ratified, he was accused of sexual harassment. We've seen people like State Senator Ira Silverstein, Tim Mapes, Chief of Staff for House Speaker Michael Madigan, both lose their positions. There's been other men who have gone down in the wake of this. It's certainly influencing some of the policy going on. Daisy can talk more about the legislative inspector general. A lot of the talk has been kind of about who watches the watchmen, because people are being more open about the fact that it's also an issue at the Capitol. There were over 150 people who signed a letter. And so we're still right in the midst of that.
And Daisy, this inspector general position, we found out that had been vacant, and people who were making claims or, you know, allegations, those were not even getting heard because there was nobody there to investigate.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely more scrutiny now. I mean, the last time someone held the job full time was in 2015. And while this letter was going around trying to reform how legislators were being held accountable for harassment, you know, more training, not just for legislators, but also for lobbyists within the state house, it came to light that the Ethics Commission had not appointed or voted on a legislative inspector general for quite some time, and that there were 27 complaints, not necessarily all harassment related, that had been filed but not acted upon during this vacancy. So then the commission temporarily appointed a former federal prosecutor, Julie Porter, to kind of investigate those complaints. And now, just recently, a year later, a legislative inspector general was appointed by the commission. Carol Pope, she's a former circuit court judge, and she will be the one, once the General Assembly votes on her appointment, to look at these claims moving forward.
And Daisy and Rachel, before we move on, I do want to ask a question on this because, okay, you mentioned it's been a year till they finally got this position, you know, permanently filled. And then I know there's these other commissions that are taking place and have been looking at possible changes and maybe in law, at least in some other policies. Why is it taking so long? I mean, that seems to me it could have been something that they probably could have really fast-tracked and got something done earlier. Maybe this is the proper approach. I'm just not sure.
I mean, for the last year, legislators that I've talked to said, you know, we don't want this to be a reaction type of thing where we just put in legislation in place just so that we can say that we did something. We want to look at everything from every angle to make sure that we're doing this the right way. And it's just kind of like gun legislation. You know, you don't, after a shooting happens, you don't want to enact legislation just as a reaction to that. You want to take your time to do that. And I think that's what a lot of these legislators have been saying, forming commissions left and right and meeting periodically.
I think it's worth noting, too, you know, the gist seems to be, well, nothing's really happened since then. We talk a lot. But, we can link to the measures that have been introduced and passed to fill kind of some of these common sense gaps. For instance, Senate Bill 405, it was passed, and it requires all companies who do business with the state of Illinois to have a sexual harassment policy. They didn't up until this point. And so there's a number of other measures like that. Susana Mendoza, who headed one of these commissions, meanwhile, is just saying, like, one of the major issues here is we need more female representation in state government.
And the election didn't necessarily increase that amount by a lot.
Right. Illinois is already in the top 10% when it comes to female representation. We're around 35%. I think it was 3 female senators who were added to the roster this year. So not a huge change in the year of the woman in Illinois, but some would argue that Illinois was already in a higher position anyway.
Just a couple of minutes left here, but Brian, something did occur this year that hasn't happened in a while. Illinois passed a budget and on time.
Yeah, shocking development for Illinois, sadly. This happened after a fair amount of debate and give and take and partisan wrangling, but that's what you want to see when you pass a budget. It was, however, largely a maintenance budget. This is not something that had a lot of great changes or anything like that, but merely the fact of it happening was noteworthy in Illinois, sadly. And remember, it comes less than a year because we went into the, on time in Illinois is May 31st. A year earlier in July, they had to go here for days and days of session in the summer and pass a budget over the governor's veto to end the 2-year budget stalemate. Now, Governor Rauner continued to rail against the tax increase that was passed at the same time as when the budget stalemate ended. But ultimately, his budget proposal and the budget he signed spent the money from the tax increase. So it seems like Illinois certainly has a permanently higher income tax rate to work with now, but even that, unfortunately, has not proven to be enough. And so that's why you have J.B. Pritzker, who campaigned on a changing Illinois to a progressive or graduated income tax. That's something that will continue to be a discussion. He's said he's going to make a big push of it in his new administration.
And Charlie, that budget that was approved was not without its critics.
No, there were a lot of people who said, well, it's not truly balanced. On paper, it is. But it's balanced by taking into account such things as selling, for example, the Thompson Center in Chicago's Loop. And that will realize $270 million that got factored in to the revenues. They also factored in, we're going to save $400 million from this new pension buyout plan. That's yet to be implemented, and I don't think we've had any savings from that yet. So they have these kinds of numbers built in, and if you take at face value what the General Assembly passed and what they've reported in their budget summary put out by the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, we're going to wind up with a surplus, including those suspicious things that I mentioned, of $11 million on a base of roughly $36 billion. So there's a long way to go. Plus, it's counting on borrowing something like $600 million from other funds. So the big task, I think, for J.B. Pritzker and the incoming Democratic majorities is going to be, how do we put together a budget for FY 2020?
And Brian, just about 20 seconds or so, but we won't know the incoming governor, the governor-elect, we won't know his budget proposal for at least a couple of more months.
Yeah, that's currently scheduled, I believe, for February. That's the usual time of the budget message. There's talk that he may combine the State of the State address and the budget message, give him a little more time when he ramps up. But we've seen from his staff he's bringing in people who have a fair amount of experience in state budgeting, state government. But there's going to be a lot of eyes on this because this is his first, the state budgets is how state government, you can really kind of peer into the soul of state government by trying to understand its budget. So a lot of people are going to be reading it very closely.
That will do it for this week and also for this year. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and also Rachel Otwell. Thanks for listening in 2018. We'll be here in 2019 as a new administration takes over state government. Get a podcast of our show each week at nprillinois.org or find us on NPR One. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.